Good afternoon. This is Dr. Dan Guerra, Authentic Biochemistry Podcast. This is chapter number 5, Mosaic 2 on plasmalogens. I want to correct myself yesterday. I think 3 or 4 times I used the word prostaglandins rather than plasmalogens. Obviously, this is a mosaic series of lectures on plasmalogens, not on prostaglandins. So every time I said that, of course, I meant plasmalogens. Now, I will tell you that earlier in this series of lectures, I did tell you that the number 2 position of these plasmalogens, which of course have this vinyl ether linkage only on the 1 position, there is fatty acid that is typically phospholipase out. And that fatty acid goes to cyclooxygenase or lipoxygenase derivatization to pro-inflammatory eicosanoids, some of which fall into the subclass prostaglandins. And in fact, plasmalogens are linked to the pro-inflammatory response precisely because of that activity. So there is an association of prostaglandin biosynthesis from plasmalogens. And that is not an uncommon event. So, okay, so let's go and finish off our discussion of circular RNAs and the production of plasmalogens, and of course the association with the peroxisomal biogenesis. It's kind of where we were last time. Remember that alkyl glycerone phosphate synthase, now that is the enzyme that takes the fatty acid from the 1 position and swaps it out for the alcohol. So that the initial generation of the ether bond occurs because of this reaction. This is a peroxisomal enzyme that has to be translocated by that PEX7 receptor-mediated response. Remember that, because of the signal peptide on that protein and other proteins that make it to the interior of the peroxisome. Okay. That enzyme, AGPS, when it is inactivated, of course, you're going to get a decrease in plasmalogens. And that whole process has been linked to a potential for pharmacotherapy because the lower level of plasmalogen is linked to a decrease in cancer pathology. So remember that AGPS overexpression, which of course is linked to a higher level of plasmalogen biosynthesis, is also linked to enhancement of tumor development and metastasis. And I told you this occurs in many different cancers. Ovarian, breast cancer metastatic, as well as primary breast cancer, and prostate cancer, just to name a few. Then I told you that AGPS in thyroid cancer seems to be linked to the expression of the enzyme AGPS, which again is considered one of the rate-limiting reactions for the de novo synthesis of plasmalogens via the peroxisomal endoplasmic reticulum pathway, right? So we've been talking about these circular RNAs, and eventually we're going to get to an association of the production of these circular RNAs by the expression of AGPS and the level of thyroid cancer development. Okay, so there's going to be a huge study on what is the potentiation of plasmalogen biosynthesis to circular RNA production, and that has to do with splice variation. We're going to go back into that mechanism like I promised. And that splice mechanism then is going to change gene expression at the RNA level. because these circular RNAs are going to regulate microRNAs and messenger RNAs in various ways. And obviously that's going to have a direct effect on translatability of messenger RNA. And when that occurs, you're going to change, first of all, the pre-transcriptomal settings in the cell, and then the proteomal alteration will also be altered. All of this because of changes in plasmalogen biosynthesis. So that's why we're on this in this particular mosaic. All right, so remember simply circular RNAs are a non-coding RNA, and they're generated by what is known as backsplicing of a pre-mRNA. And that's what I was trying to get into. So there are various types of mechanisms for this, and I think they're rather interesting. We also mentioned to you that that segment of the RNA that is most commonly being derivatized to generate a circular RNA comes from DNA that has high levels of ALU repeats. Now, these repeats are very common in the human genome, and they have been linked to transposon mutagenesis. That is the inappropriate recombination of ALU elements into various regions of chromosomal DNA, corrupting via this massive mutational event normal gene structure, and therefore subsequently gene expression at the transcriptional level. All right. So that's why people are interested in them. Now, the reason they're called ALU, obviously that's a restriction endonuclease. So this DNA is going to have high levels of ALU sequence homology. So that's why they're called ALU repeats. Just want, and remember, they're about 280 base pair long regions, these ALU elements. And they seem to have diverged ancestrally from a 7SL RNA gene. So the 3' end of the ALU element has a long adenosine-rich region that plays a critical role in the amplification mechanism for ALU-rich sequences. So these ALU-rich sequences are also involved in associated gene duplications. And you know, gene duplications will give you copy number variation, and this can lead to various pathophysiologies, diseases eventually coming down to be the final presentation. Okay? So these ALU elements are interesting because they have an internal RNA polymerase 3 promoter. So rather than RNA pol 2, which is the normal transcriptional regulator of messenger RNA transcription, RNA polymerase 3 has a unique substrate for transcription. And one of those unique substrates are ALU elements. Now, all this again, remember, is linking back to plasmalogens. Okay, the literature I'm reading about, simply about circular RNAs and ALU elements, I'm giving you the foundational background. But we're still discussing how plasmalogens seem to mediate a higher level of these circular RNAs. So you need to understand more about the mechanism, and that's what I'm doing here. Now, another interesting thing about these ALU elements within these circular RNAs is they don't possess a termination signal for transcription. So they'll end up terminating at variable, non-associated genomic locations where there will be a run of thymine. So there'll have to be at least 4 or 5 T residues in order to cause termination. And that will generate now a faux termination or terminator sequence. So that's an interesting thing too. So without that subsequent hard stop termination, that's why these repeats can carry with them marginal sections of DNA, which can then be duplicated in the genome as the ALU rich sequence is carrying out its transposition, which is an errant form of recombination. All right. So that's, I think, as much as I want to say. Now, something about this overall process is interesting. So I'm gonna, I just find it interesting because I've done recombination work, DNA recombination work in my research history. So you have direct back splicing, and this is where the exons are essentially spliced in a non-canonical order. And what that then obtains is a 5' splice site, and now that's going to be called the donor, to an upstream 3' splice site, which is going to be called the acceptor region. And that's how you generate the circular transcript, which will be the circRNA. Now, another mechanism is simply that lariat splicing. And that will involve a generation of a lariat intermediate, which will have exons, and eventually introns will be included in the lariat, but they will be removed. And when they are removed, all that's left behind is exon circular RNA. So the lariat structure removes the introns directly. But both of those mechanisms have been described well in vivo, in cell culture. And although they work with the canonical spliceosome, which has been well described, is splicing RNA, which simply means removing the introns and putting the exons together to prepare finally the mRNA ready for translocation. Before, well, first it has to be 5' capped and 3' polyadenylated, and then it's sent out in the cytoplasm. So the whole spliceosomal machinery is where the circular RNAs are occurring. So right now I want you to imagine, how is this peroxisomal generated plasmalogen, which ends up in the inner leaflet of the plasma membrane at pretty high mole percent, actually, as a unique lipid, because it's an ether lipid, although it's a phosphoglycerol lipid. How does that lipid production have something to do with what's going on in the nucleus to generate these non-coding circular RNAs utilizing these ALU-rich sequences, right? So it's all a very, a system that has been described, but the exact mechanism for sending the signal from the plasmalogen lipid found in the membrane to what's occurring in the nucleus to generate either these exonal or intronal circular RNAs, that mechanism is still being studied. Okay, like, what is the signal transduction? So as you might guess, there's a lot of potential for sense and antisense RNA transcripts to be formed, because during that splicing operation, because of homologous pairing in different regions of the, what will become the exonal or the intronal circular RNA, some of that RNA is going to be removed. And some of that RNA is going to be in the sense orientation and in the antisense orientation. And you know that antisense RNA to a sense strand of a messenger RNA will cooperatively and with complementary bind to that homologous region. And when that occurs, double-stranded RNA forms are made that are no longer translatable. This is yet another mechanism for circular RNA generation and the processing of those circular RNAs by, say, removal via the lariat structure to generate antisense RNAs, which will then go on to diminish the expression of whatever that RNA sequence is complementary to at an mRNA level. Okay? So this is kind of like a powerhouse to generate multiple levels of regulation of RNA biochemistry, both at the splicing, so this is still at the level of RNA, messenger RNA synthesis in the nucleus, all the way out to the cytosol, or in fact, even in the endoplasmic reticulum where this RNA can be sent for the translational event. Okay. So that's a very interesting point of view, right? Considering what these circular RNAs are all about. Now, there is a ribonuclear, that is, ribosomal protein-associated circulation process. So ribosomal binding proteins are also very important for certain molecular species that are tissue-specific of circRNA. Okay? So obviously, you're still going to have specific flanking intronic regions here. And for example, there are the ALU repeats that I've already explained to you. And those are a major binding target for these ribosomal binding proteins. So the ribosomal binding proteins have an affinity for that RNA, which is in the process of being used to generate circular RNA with introns. Okay? Now, here's where it gets slightly complicated. One of the major binding sites for ALU repeats is the adenosine deaminase 1. That's an enzyme that acts on RNA. So that enzyme, again, is the acronym is ADAR1. We've talked about it before. So this is what has been observed. ADAR1 inhibits circular RNA formation. And it does so by a destabilization of the paired elements, that is the complementary elements. And the elements that are most commonly found in this complex are the ALU repeats. So the way that that ADAR enzyme does this inhibition is it will convert an adenosine to an inosine, because that's what adenosine deaminase 1, the enzyme, that's what its properties are as an enzyme. It's a catalytic event. So what will occur there is the potentiation of double-stranded RNA intermediates. When there are more double-stranded RNA intermediates, there's a higher level of adenosine to inosine transformation via the ADAR1 enzyme. Okay? Now, there are various other proteins involved in this process, and I don't know how deep I want to get into it. You know, what I do is I really want to get all the information to the Authentic Biochemistry audience rather than just going blowing by it. And of course, what I do is I get much deeper than normally what I'm going to give you in the lecture. But I'll mention to you that there are other proteins involved. There's one called the QKI. Those are known as quaking proteins. And they seem also to be related to promoting circular RNA formation. And what they promote is the exon circulation. And they bind to a specific sequence. I won't give you that sequence right now. So the second exon of the splicing factor, wait for it, muscle blind, that's called MBL, promotes its circulation to form a circular MBL, which then can join with MBL itself to reduce the MBL transcript, eventually reducing also the circular MBL synthesis. So that's all in association with RNA binding proteins. Okay? So what did I just say? That RNA binding proteins promote the biogenesis of circular RNAs, but they also have an inhibitory effect. on circular RNA stability, depending on what the target is in the RNA level, because these are exons, not introns. So the exons are going to be for specific genes. I just told you the name of the gene, MBL. See? Now, there are other examples of this in other very interesting gene targets, such as helicase 9. So these helicase enzymes, as you know, are involved in unwinding DNA for replication, recombination, repair, and transcription. So what's really interesting here is that the RNA binding proteins function apparently as a editing device within the genome to generate circular RNAs so that eventually downstream, the sequence of events will lead to an inhibition of the expression of that gene. And of course, all of this will get cleared away within a cell cycle. So these RNAs, these circular RNAs aren't going to make it through cell cycle. So what it appears to suggest, at least from my observation from reading this literature in the last 3 or 4 days, is that this production of circular RNAs, which seems to be appropriated via plasmalogen biosynthesis, particularly the expression of the JGPS gene, which remember is when that gene is transcribed and translated, that enzyme will take the fatty acid in the one position of dihydroxyacetone phosphate and then transfer that off and then pick up a fatty alcohol and put an alcohol in that position, now generating that ether lipid, which is going to be the precursor of the plasmalogen. And plasmalogen, of course, will require that desaturase enzyme to finally put in that vinyl linkage. Okay? You see? So there's something about the retailering of these lipids. That's what really was going on here. You're getting a retailering of phosphoglycerol lipid that's already synthesized, basically, into generating an ether lipid. And the ether lipid then is going to play a role back in the nucleus, because of its level of production in the inner leaflet of the membrane. Remember, the flip base is going to organize where the ether lipid's found. If it's found in the inner leaflet of the plasma membrane, it has a role in regulating this circular RNA. If it's on the outer leaflet, which can occur because the flip base works both ways, at that point, you silence the effect of the plasmalogen on transcriptional control of circular RNA, which is editing essentially messenger RNA processing at the level of splicing, and ultimately the expression of that messenger RNA via polyribosomal translation or ribosomal translation in the endoplasmic reticulum. Because some of these proteins will be synthesized in the ER, and some of them will be synthesized by polyribosomes in the cytoplasm. Okay, so that's why it's an interesting part of this mosaic. You see, and it adds to the complexity of the story of these plasmalogens. We already have been talking about the fact that plasmalogens regulate peroxisomal genesis. Now that's an amazing statement, because the peroxisome will proliferate, right? Because of the fusion reactions like we were talking about with mitochondria. Remember the whole discussion of fusion and fission in mitochondria? Hopefully you do from the last mosaic. Well, that same story happens with peroxisomes. Remember, the peroxisome has to be associated with the ER membrane, like that ER contact point. And that when it makes that ER contact point and plasmalogens start to be generated, that causes peroxisomal division. And remember what the peroxisome is involved in. It's involved in its own beta oxidation, but of the fatty acids, well, very long chain with multiple double bonds. So this is a way to explain how fatty acyl groups that come from the essential fatty acids, linoleic and alpha-linolenic, that generate arachidonate, icosapentaenoate and docosahexaenoate that end up in the membrane have a communication network to the alteration of the pretranscriptome and the proteome of the cell that is regulating that biogenesis of the peroxisome. And remember, the peroxisome is turning over those polyunsaturated fatty acids. And the reason that those fatty acids are turned over in the peroxisome is because there's a high level of H2O2 being generated that has to be removed. And if that H2O2 is being generated in the mitochondria, you would lose electron transport chain and the entire necessary ATPase component for the bioenergetics that the mitochondria is responsible for, and the peroxisome is not. This also explains to me why the peroxisomal division is not linked to cell division, much like mitochondrial genome. So it seems that the peroxisome and the mitochondria are interrelating their communication network of membrane phospholipid alterations to alter the transcriptome and the proteome of a cell to deal with changes in external environment and internal processing of errant or appropriate but incorrectly timed level of gene expression. So stress responses in general. You see how this is a really, this becomes a much more florid phenomenon. So as a biochemist, you know, what you do when you're a biochemist for many years, you tend not to think too much about cell biology, because cell biology is done by cell biologists, right? So what's going on with the mitochondria and the peroxisome, the epithelial reticulum and the Golgi and all those endomembranous endosomal compartments and lysosomal compartments is something of interest to us because of the stress phenomena. And they're also just normal bioenergetics and canonical biochemistry, of course. But the cell biology component isn't necessarily emphasized in biochemistry. But what I've always done in biochemistry class is get deeper into what the process is for the cell. So I'm not coming looking at the cell as like, I heard this once when I was in graduate school, and I even know who said it, but I won't use the name. A person who was teaching biochemistry in the chemistry department said, yeah, well, the cell is just a bag of enzymes. Of course, that person probably had been trained as a chemist, not from the biology training. And many biochemists come from chemistry backgrounds rather than biology. And they learned biology later on, maybe in graduate school, they take a course or two. I was really lucky that I started out as a physiologist, particularly a plant physiologist. So all of my earlier work, in fact, my graduate work, was in studying biological systems, physiology primarily, but because I was interested in biochemistry, even at the early stages of my graduate career, I always did biochemical research, you see? But my foundation was in biology. So still, that carries forward into what I study now and how I'm interested in cell biology, that is subcellular organelle organization related to signal transduction cascades, which we're talking about here. This also gives you this old concept I was telling you a couple nights ago, I think it was the Saturday night lecture, on the bias that scientists can bring into the research. So my bias, and certainly I'm sure I have it, is I'm interested in the overall organization of the living system and less on just the chemistry of the different organic compounds that are being altered because of enzymatic activity, turnover, etc. So the biology is always a primary interest to me. And that's why I go in and study the molecular cellular biology of the system. And particularly, I think this is like advanced biochemistry. And that's what these mosaics are supposed to be. If I was going to be teaching a new course in graduate or even in medical biochemistry or in pharmaceutical biochemistry, I would be teaching mosaics, because this is really what's going on in the living system. All these interactions, not simply these biochemical pathways occurring and all their regulation, which is beautiful and significant enough, but how all of that functions to provide and to obtain in the end the living system. Dr. Dan Guerra, Authentic Biochemistry Podcast. Monday afternoon, 4 March 2024 by